From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, an exclusive interview with Congo Zaire rebel leader, Laurent Kabila.
We are fighting against the regime which Mobutu has been the mastermind person since the beginning of the independence of this country. And then they have all of them looted the country together. We are not accepting at any cost a compromise with the Mobutis.
Then we'll speak with an opposition leader in Kenya about the implications of Mobutu Sese Seko's fall for the rest of Africa. And in this country, the advertising industry holds its versions of the Oscars. We'll talk about the Counter Clio Awards. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. With vast deposits of cobalt, copper, and diamonds, 50 million people, and borders alongside nine different countries in Africa, Zaire has long been one of the most strategic and important countries in Africa, and indeed the world. For the last 32 years, the country has been ruled by Mobutu Sese Seko, who distinguished himself not only as a murderous tyrant, but as a foe of liberation movements in Angola and Mozambique, and an eager client of U.S., Britain, France, as well as apartheid South Africa prior to the end of white rule. But now Mobutu Sese Seko's dictatorship is nearly over. A rebel force known as the Alliance of Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Congo Zaire has swept through the country this last year and now stands at the gates of the capital, Kinshasa. The guerrilla army of the Alliance of Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Congo Zaire, known as the ADFL, is led by Laurent Kabila, a longtime rebel leader and foe of Mobutu. Today on Democracy Now!, we bring you an exclusive interview with Laurent Kabila. It was done by Alambe Brath, who is head of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition, an African internationalist organization based in Harlem, New York, which has provided a public forum for African leaders and activists coming to this country. Alambe Brath is also a producer at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, where we're broadcasting from today, and he did the interview just a few hours ago. Alambe, you spoke to Kabila in Lubumbashi, Zaire, the mineral capital of the country. Can you tell us how you got the interview?
Well, I've been trying for a long time to get an interview with Laurent Kabila months ago when we first heard that he was leading up the alliance. And I had been talking with a Dr. Mwana Mwana Papanga, who was at the University of Kentucky, teaching there the economy. And what happened is that he went over, and he was very much trying to get them moving in the communications area, which he felt they were lacking. And when he came back, he said they had asked him to come out to be the finance minister, which he has taken that post, and most people will see his name in the paper quoted often when you see the deals that are going on now, or the kind of transactions. And so I finally was able to try to track him down, because it's very hard where they are. They were moving from place to place, and you know, most of the things they can do is with cellular phones, and it's very difficult.
So he's left his post at the University of Kentucky.
Yeah, he left his post some time ago, and he's been out there for several months now. I followed him, and I started to see his name crop up in the paper, and I kept in contact with his family here. So I finally was able to track him down, and as a result of that, he was always in contact with Kabila, even when he was here. And we used to have him on the airways talking about what Kabila had said. He actually went to Kabila and told him what we had been doing. And as a result of that, we were able to get that interview. He was involved with a whole lot of meetings. And he told me, look, if you can come in, if you can correspond your time to mine, I have a slot at 11 o'clock this morning, which is, that's his time, 5 o'clock, our time. So
right,
we said we'd
York.
Be here. So we were here. We were here in the studio waiting, you know, to make sure that we got that call.
You're the head of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't even know who Patrice Lumumba is. Yeah. Can you tell us who he is and how he relates to Laurent Kabila?
Right. Patrice Lumumba was the first prime minister of the Congo, which received his independence on the 30th of June, 1960. He was the prime minister. Joseph Kasavubu was the president. And the person in the president's office who was the secretary was one Joseph Désiré Mobutu. In any event, Lumumba, who was the only Congolese leader to be able to put forth a national party, that was the Congolese National Movement, he found himself in a situation where the imperialist powers did not want him to take power. But anyway, he was still able to bring about the Congo's independence. Now, once that happened, there was a whole lot of turmoil in the Congo by the Belgians coming back, claiming that the nationals were being violated and what have you. And then there was a secessionist movement by one Moise Tshombe, or the richest province, now called Shaba, before called Katanga. And all of these things developed where Lumumba had to come here and ask for the United Nations to come in. They, in turn, did not follow what his lead was. And what happened later on was that the United States, the Eisenhower administration, was very much against Lumumba, and they intervened by contacting Mobutu, now Mobutu Sese Seko, and they had him interrupt the government. So the first coup against Lumumba took place on the 14th of September 1960, only a few months after the country became independent, and eventually led to Lumumba's assassination. And Kabila, Laurent Kabila, was one of the people who followed in his wake as the Lumumbas and fought physically armed struggle in 1964, from 1964 until today.
Where has he been?
Well, he has been in the neighboring countries. He's been in Zaire, but he has not had any contact with Mobutu. He was one of the few people who didn't at one point feel, look, I'm out here too long. Let me come back and make peace with Mobutu. So he never did that, you know. And then he was, you know, trying to conduct business, you know, to sustain himself. But the main time he's been in the various neighboring countries, all who had problems with the Mobutu regime, and therefore he's long known there. He's not a person that is unknown to the people of Zaire or the Congo or to the neighboring countries. They know him and know him as a person, as a resolute fighter against Mobutu. Well, Mobutu had a military operation that was supported by the West, and one that any time he needed, he could bring them in, and mercenaries. So the achievement that they made in the last 7 months is something that's remarkable.
You know, today's Financial Times, the headline is Mobutu built $4 billion fortune. Zaire's dictator plundered IMF loans, and it says 30 years of embezzlement by Zaire's ruling elite allowed President Mobutu Sese Seko to accumulate a fortune which peaked at $4 billion in the mid-1980s. This according to a Financial Times investigation. Despite a formal warning in 1982 by a senior official of the International Monetary Fund that the Zairean state was endemically corrupt, Western governments continued to support loans totaling close to $4 billion in multilateral and bilateral aid between 1982 and 1991.
It was estimated in about 1979, I believe, that Mobutu's wealth was the equivalent to the national debt of Zaire. That is, that if they could actually retrieve the money that he had actually stolen at that time, the country would probably be financially solvent. And at that time, of course, he was considered the second richest leader in the world, only second to the Shah of Iran.
Well, here we go now to Alambe Brath's interview with what looks like the next leader of Zaire, Congo, and that is Laurent Kabila.
So now we would like to know what is actually happening right now in the Congo.
In Congo right now, I think everybody here in the liberated area is celebrating the liberation struggle, which is just closing to the last objective, which is the fall of state power in Kinshasa in few days' time. And this is maybe the main topic, and for us it is the main objective. We must take the state power where it is unless the negotiation, that I mean, Mr. Mobutu surrendering power to the alliance and only to the alliance is done. If that fact, if it's done, so I think we can change it. We can go into state power by soft landing, as other people are saying it.
But if he doesn't turn over the power immediately, because I understand the Alliance for the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Congo are still moving, and Mobutu has returned for Gabon, and I understand he appointed Onango as the new prime minister. I got a call from some people.
You see, we don't allow Mr. Mobutu to change his place with another Mobutist.
That's right.
We can't accept anybody else than Mobutu to relinquish power to the FDL. And we do not recognize anybody else in his camp because they are all Mobutists. We are fighting against the regime which Mobutu has been the mastermind person since the beginning of the independence of this country. And then they have all of them looted the country together. We are not accepting at any cost a compromise with the Mobutists. So Mobutu has to go to relinquish power to the FDL. That is on Wednesday, the day after tomorrow, and that is what we agreed upon. The meeting we had previously on the ship, that he wanted to have 8 days to think at, to consult his people, and I think he has done it now. So we are going there just to proceed to the peaceful transfer of power from the dictatorship regime to the people of the alliance. I think that is the only thing we are expecting on the meeting of Wednesday.
In that regard, what do you think that the people here who want to see a resolution of this problem favorable to the Congolese people could do to facilitate that that particular ending? What can we actually tell the government here or the people here who would want to block the alliance from taking state power totally?
Well, I think people there should be informed about the intrigues, machination, and all manipulations of keeping our country under a clique of puppets of foreign countries, so that the confusion, the misery can continue. And I think for those who like to see this country to become again a democratic one, where freedom will enable these people to rebuild again their countries, I think what they can do is just to ask those big powers, the government of U.S., United States of America, and other Western countries, to give a chance to the people of this democratic Congo to settle themselves their disputes about the political crisis in this country, because they know, absolutely, they know they have been making political business with the regime which we are now defeating. And they know how the regime has impoverished the people here and destroyed all infrastructure within the country and even blocked the whole tentative of development of the country. So it is a big time for those big powers to leave alone the people of this country, to express their will by restricting the government institutions, the way of managing the public affairs by their own will. And I think that is the most important. They can't now come in imposing lot of conditions and choosing for our people who should be the leader again and again. So I think that is what we need from the people of America, from the people who are following the situation here, which is not very complex, one very complicated, but they are trying to complicate it by machination, intrigue, so that the Mobutists, the one who has destroyed this country, remain again in power without their boss Mobutu once gone. So that is, we can ask them, we expect to you, all of you, to make pressure on the USA government to stop in any way to try to approach again the people by putting them as the masters who have been there since the old time, and let the people of this country choose their own leaders. I think that is what is most important expected from you.
I thank you for that. I just wanted to raise one more point. I noticed that that you have reestablished the Congo flag of the First Democratic Republic of the Congo, the flag of the Lumumba government, and you have renamed everything, all of the places, the Congo River. Go back to the original, and I think that it's going to be very interesting when the 37th anniversary of the independence comes up on June 30th, and even a couple of days later, the birthday of Lumumba. Can we expect to see any events, you know, that will actually celebrate all of these things?
Oh, of course. Of course. The 30th June, the Day of Independence, will be celebrated everywhere because, you see, it is just going back to the source. And we shall be very happy and even proud to think again as Congolese and absolutely free from the situation in where we have been held by Mobutu and his ally from outside the country and the regime itself. I think it will be a very great day, the 30th January. It is a day of remembering of the Congo as it was from the origin, and definitely is a great day. We think we shall inform you about what will be put on place so that we can celebrate that day and recall again the Congo once with Lumumba and all the fathers of the independence.
And we hope to be there with you, Mr. President.
We hope so. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for this, and we'll be getting back to you after Wednesday to find out the next, what is the conclusion of the discussions.
With great pleasure and interest, please. You call us, we shall be informed.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Thank you. Same to you.
And that was Rebel leader Laurent Kabila speaking with WBAI Pacifica producer Alambe Brath. He was speaking from Lubumbashi, Zaire. Again, Laurent Kabila, the head of the guerrilla army of the Alliance of Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Congo Zaire, known as the ADFL. They say they will accept nothing less on Friday than the resignation of the dictator Mobutu Sese Seko. You've been listening to an exclusive Pacifica interview with Laurent Kabila. When we come back, we'll be joined by a Kenyan opposition leader talking about what the fall of Mobutu Sese Seko means for the rest of Africa. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Again, if you're just tuning in, we just played an exclusive interview with Laurent Kabila, the rebel leader of the Alliance of Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Congo Zaire. On Wednesday, he will be meeting on a South African Navy ship with Mobutu Sese Seko, calling for his resignation. And to summarize what he just said in that interview, power must go directly to the Alliance forces. They will not accept some kind of interim government, which is being pushed by the Western forces. He says Mobutu must be out on Wednesday. He is calling for a rebuilding of the country and wants the people of Congo to be given a chance to settle disputes for themselves without the interference of the big powers. He says that Zairians should not be told who their leader will be again and again. And he says that the attempt to install another interim government is simply an attempt by the Mobutuist forces to stay in power. And finally, he called on Americans to put pressure on the United States government not to interfere with the Congo, which will be the new name of Zaire when Mobutu Sese Seko falls. Well, right now, we're joined by Dennis James Akumu, who is a longtime member of the parliament in Nairobi, Kenya, where he presently chairs the Parliamentary Committee on Housing, Labor, and Manpower Development. He was formerly the Secretary General of the Organization of African Trade Union Unity between 1973 and 1986, and was also the former Secretary General of the Central Organization of Trade Unions in Kenya. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, why don't I start by getting your reaction to Laurent Kabila in this interview he did with Lombe Brath?
Well, first, I'm quite glad that Lombe has kept in touch with not only Congo, but with Africa. I know him very well for nearly 30 years as a Pan-Africanist. I don't like the idea of calling Kabila a rebel because I knew him as the people that fought for independence with Lumumba. I knew Lumumba, I know of him, and he kept the spirit of Lumumba all these years. In fact, if anything, he's the legitimate people that hold the Lumumbaist spirit, and it is Lumumba that brought independence. Mobutu was a usurper and imposed by the Western powers. Now, I fully agree with Kabila that United States and Western government cannot today say that they want to see a transitional government, that they want the election organized soon. They've had put Mobutu in power for 32 years. There was never a proper election. And it would be ridiculous to ask Kabila today, within a very short time, to organize election in a country of 50 million, huge as it is. We expect him to take over the government, run the government, restore some dignity, then see us when he can organize elections. I'm quite happy, and I'm really hoping, I fully support his stand, that it's not a question of negotiation, not a question of transitional government. It's a question of handing over power to ADR. And they will then examine how to restore dignity, how to organize the country, and eventually see how they can organize democratic elections. And the West cannot tell Congolese about democracy after supporting 32 years of a dictatorship. And I also want to appeal to the American government in particular that they can repair some of the damage that America has done in Africa. One of them, a leading one, was in Congo, imposing Mobutu, knowing that he's a looter, killing, doing everything that we did. But not just that. Look at what America's done in Angola, supporting Savimbi up to now. And look at what they've done in Mozambique. They can begin to repair this, the new administration, Clinton, by at least making sure that Mobutu, and I happen to know, I know this because I was in the struggle far back up 58, that if America tells Mobutu, pack up and leave now, he will leave. That he went back on the advice of Belgium and France, that if they tell him to leave, he will pack and leave. And that one, they want to use him as a bargaining chip, which I think is disappointing. And that is going to upset the African more.
A bargaining chip for what? What does France and Belgium and the United States have to gain?
Because they want to continue to loot those resources. Zaire is strategically very important in terms of influence around Africa, but Zaire is also extremely rich. Cobalt, you know what cobalt makes, made out of cobalt, gold, diamond, and so on. Zaire is extremely rich. They want to continue. They want to get, in fact, I'm glad Kabila said it very well. They want Mobutuism to continue without Mobutu. They want to continue to loot. They are getting these things very cheaply. The people are miserable poor, and there's a rich country, rich in everything, but the people are extremely poor. And all the wealth is France, Belgium, United States, and so on.
What does Mobutu falling in Zaire mean for Kenya first, your country, and for the rest of Africa?
Well, you know, when the Kabila put the forces together, first we must give him credit for bringing all the groups together under him. And he started pushing. Mobutu's friend Moi started convening a meeting under pretext of peace.
Moi being Daniel Arap Moi, the leader of your country,
the
Kenya.
President of Kenya. And we insisted that if he really meant peace, we doubted, but if he really meant peace, he should call Kabila. He refused. We tried to put this privately. A little bit, we went public in Parliament. We called press conference and denounced the meeting. And I'm glad that other leaders saw that it was useless talking peace with the representative of Mobutu without Kabila. But let me tell you, we are all very happy. Many of us that fought and wanted genuine independence and were disappointed to see independence betrayed in Africa everywhere by dictators, many of them, you know, like Banda and everyone. We are glad that the fall of Mobutu would be a warning not just to Moi, it's a warning to people like Bongo, Babacha. There are many of them. It is a general warning. I think it is a good wind.
You know, it seems to me, though, that U.S. policy in Africa encourages armed revolution in Africa, encourages armed forces, because the only time the U.S. started to say, well, Mobutu should leave about a month ago was when Kabila, with his rebel forces, was taking over more than a half of the country, now three quarters of the country, and that they don't step back until there is an armed revolt. Just pro-democracy activists doesn't do it for the United States.
Well, I want to agree with you, because for the last 10 years, a number of my friends in Zaire have been pushing for changes. There's been a transitional parliament for 8 years trying to fix election. There's never been election. So I can tell you for certain that United States and Western governments Because even today, Britain is supporting a government like that of Moi. They've never talked about corruption. Even civil servants in the United Nations have already indicated that Kenya, Nigeria, and Pakistan are the most corrupt countries in the whole world. Kenya, Nigeria, and Pakistan are the most corrupt. But, you know, the British still support, they still say that Moi should still be there. Now, it's very disappointing that the United States that goes around telling people about democracy, when it comes to looting, when it comes to getting wealth, when it comes to doing this, they're prepared to support dictators. And it's very disappointing indeed.
We're talking to Dennis James Akumu, who is a longtime member of the Kenyan Parliament, where he presently chairs the Parliamentary Committee on Housing, Labor, and Manpower Development, also a former Secretary General of the Organization of African Trade Union Unity. What about Kenya in particular? You've got Daniel Arap Moi. The United States does not refer to him as a dictator, does not talk about the human rights abuses in Kenya. How does this empower opposition people like you in Kenya?
Well, let me say this, that a former United States ambassador, Hempston, was fairly good in pushing, not only for multi-party, but also bringing questions like human rights violation. Currently, there's a serious deadlock. You know, last weekend, the third, there was a big rally and there was confrontation. Moi used troops to break a meeting of thousands of people in Nairobi. The opposition are insisting that there should be no election without minimum reforms because the present constitution was drafted in such a way that it favors Moi's party. And this is a very important factor. We have put this very strongly to the United States and Britain that they should, again, we happen to know, that if Britain and the United States were to tell Moi, do this, he will do that because he's their man.
And what does that mean? What kind of investment, what kind of support and aid does the United States give to Kenya?
Well, Britain and the United States works very closely when it comes to Africa and external affairs. Britain has heavy investment in Kenya. United States, for a long time, not very much now, but for a long time, used Mombasa Port, Malindi, and other as strategic areas for its Middle East operation. But we also know today, that Moi would not be, there would not be resisting these changes. And you know that during the last election, Moi got only 30%. The opposition got 70%. Unfortunately, they were divided. We are trying to get her Iran. He's refusing.
You know, this weekend, Clinton was in the Caribbean for a Caribbean summit, and one of the issues brought up by pro-democracy activists throughout the Caribbean is what the IMF and the World Bank, supported by the United States, support in these countries. I was just mentioning that the front page headline of the Financial Times is an expose they've done. Mobutu built $4 billion fortunes. Zaire's dictator plundered IMF loans. And it talks about the history of this multilateral investment in Zaire, knowing exactly what Mobutu is doing, and saying initially the Central Intelligence Agency backed Mobutu with a covert line of financial assistance. And throughout the 70s, export earnings were held in foreign accounts by the elite surrounding Mobutu and barely used for investment in Zaire. And that this was carefully documented by reports from the IMF. In a particular report, a senior German banker named Mr. Erwin Blumenthal. However, Western political pressure for Mobutu to be bolstered by led to IMF assistance to Zaire substantially increasing. The funding was increased after this report. Do you have the same kind of situation in Kenya?
Sounds like Kenya. It sounds exactly like Kenya. We've had a situation where we put a lot of pressure. We reached a stage where through the Scandinavian countries, they stopped giving aid to Kenya for a short time. But then the United States and Britain started saying, well, he's our friend and so on. And as I'm talking to you now, they've just released some money lately again. They also know that Kenya leadership is very corrupt. They know in details the money that is being siphoned out of the country. They also know that the friends, President Moi's children and so on, the banks that have collapsed, the banking in afloat in Bermuda and others, they know all these details. The World Bank and IMF knows this very well.
I mean, what's quite incredible about this whole scheme, now when you have a new country, in the case of the Congo, you're going to have an enormous debt that these people who've been plundered by their own dictator, supported by these banks, have to pay back.
Well, there is a very strong debate in Africa. Nyerere tried to push it 85, but there were people that were used, and they beat that one, which was that all this debt should be looked into, because some of them were money that never reached the people, never built anything. And therefore, Africa should then say, we are afraid we are not honoring this. We have very little to lose in terms of this.
Dennis James Akuma, where has Laurent Kabila been for these more than 30 years of the Mobutu dictatorship?
Well, he spent a lot of time in Eastern Sahel, as far as I know, and then sometimes in Uganda. But he also spent a long time. I was in Tanzania the other day. I didn't know. But he spent a lot of time in Tanzania for a while with Nyerere, and even for a while at the university.
With Julius Nyerere.
Yes. So he never left, and he never compromised with Mobutu. Mobutu hunted for him, tried. He eliminated people, but somehow he survived within Congo and outside.
Will countries, will groups like Savimbi's, UNITA forces, be weakened by Mobutu going down? Have they provided substantial material support?
Well, I know for certain that groups like Savimbi, groups like Renamo, which were forced...
In Mozambique.
Which were backed by the United States, armed and backed. And then the government were forced to go and negotiate with these people, that they will be greatly weakened. I'm positive about this.
You know, there's been a debate in the United States. Many conservative Republicans want to cut off almost all aid to Africa, certainly substantially reduce it. And then you've got the forces on the other side, the Democrats, many of them who are saying, no, we have to continue to invest in Africa. But given the way the money is used for support of dictators like Mobutu, support of leaders like Daniel Arap Moi in Kenya, what do you think would be the best? Do you think that actually pulling away money from Africa, the investment that the U.S. Congress has voted over the years, would be better not to be there at all?
I'm being quite honest with you that I think the way the money has been used all these years, one would have thought that money should have not been given at all. And if there should be any aid to Africa today, it should be to community-based, not government. I'm afraid this money that is sent to government is wasted. And there's a big debate today at grassroots. Shall we pay this? Shall we accept the responsibility? Part of it is our debt. And people now say that this aid is not to Kenya. It's to Moi, like it was to Mobutu. So there is a very serious debate that if anything, aid has not helped Africa. Has made Africa to become too dependent, and has made the rich, the elite, richer, and made the poorer, poorer.
Interestingly, multinational corporations are very much fighting for aid to Africa, because so much of that aid, more than half of that aid, often goes to U.S. multinational corporations. And so it's a kind of form of corporate welfare. If they can't get it here in these shores, let it be cycled through Africa and then back to the United States. Perhaps it doesn't get recycled through Africa at all.
No, you are absolutely right. The multinational corporation meets every year in Nairobi, for example, and they say how it is important that aid should be increased, and then they decide how that aid should be used, how it should be invested. And it's done through them. They have the expertise. They do the feasibility studies ready in preparation for getting those aid. So you are absolutely right. It's not aid to those Africans, to the poor Africans in the rural area. It is more of what the one get out of the country through those multinational corporations.
Well, Dennis James Akuma, we want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Dennis James Akuma is a member of the Kenyan Parliament, an opposition leader there, where he currently chairs the Parliamentary Committee on Housing, Labor, and Manpower Development. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And again, if you've just tuned in, we had Laurent Kabila on saying that they will accept nothing less, the rebel forces of Zaire, what many call the rightful governing citizens of Zaire. They will accept nothing less on Wednesday when they meet on a South African Navy ship with Mobutu, than his resignation, and that they will not accept any kind of interim government, which they see as simply an attempt by Western countries to prolong the Mobutu dictatorship in some form or other. When we come back, we're going to turn to this country to look at a very different issue. We're going to look at advertising and PR hype in this country and how it determines what we read, what we see on television, and how to fight that, how to decode that. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm Amy Goodman, and this is Democracy Now! This week in New York City, the advertising industry holds its version of the Oscars. They're called the Clio Awards. But for the first time this year, the public relations industry will be challenged by a group of media activists who will be holding a counter-Clio Awards ceremony, where they'll be handing out their own negative awards in categories like Excellence in Blaxploitation. We're pleased to be joined today by one of the presenters at the Counter Clio Awards, John Stauber. He's executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, based in Madison, Wisconsin, and the author, along with Sheldon Rampton, of Toxic Sludge is Good for You and the forthcoming book Mad Cow USA. He also edits PR Watch newsletter. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, John.
Thank you, Amy. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, we have a lot of things to talk to you about. On Friday, the headlines were about beef and about tainted beef, and we'll talk about that in a second. But first, let's talk about the Clio Awards. What are they, and what are you countering?
Well, probably most people have never heard of the Clio Awards, but the Clio Awards, as you stated, are the advertising industry's equivalent of the Oscars. The advertising industry, $100 billion a year plus business in the U.S., and a really healthy opposition to the advertising industry has grown up, especially over the last 10 years, as media activists have directly confronted the power of commercialization over our lives, the 1,500 ads that hit us every day, the public relations manipulation that's much more stealth, such as the video news releases, maybe 10,000 of them now distributed and released every year and used by TV news directors as real news when they're really advertising disguised as news. So the folks at the Media and Democracy Congress got the brilliant idea of holding a counter Clio the night before the Clio Awards. The Clio Awards are Wednesday here in Manhattan. The counter Clios are Tuesday night at NYU here. And they've brought together some of these media critics to really roast and criticize the power of commercialism to manipulate our lives, our culture, our values.
How many PR flacks, official PR flacks, are there in the United States, and how many journalists?
There are 150,000-plus public relations flacks, practitioners, in the United States, compared to 130,000 journalists. So already the number of professionals, most of whom came out of journalism backgrounds but who now work in propaganda, whose job it is to manipulate the news, journalism, public opinion on behalf of primarily big corporate clients, outnumber the working journalists in this country. It's been very interesting for me as an activist for 20 years working on a variety of issues at the community level to get into journalism, because I sort of feel like I come at it and see it in a tremendous state of demise. I edit PR Watch, and my counter Clio is going to be for the advertising best disguised as journalism. And that's, as I mentioned, the video news releases that are so rampant on television now. People think they're watching the news, and in fact, there's an unfounded confidence, faith, and trust that people have in the news. There was a Roper survey in 1994 that said that, quote, by a margin greater than 2-1, Americans believe that what they see on TV is more credible than what they read in a newspaper. Well, if anyone looks at TV critically, that's a very frightening thought. And what almost no Americans realize is that much of what they see now as TV news is really a video news release. It's what looks like a news story, but it has hidden messages in it. It's provided free via satellites to newsrooms. And virtually every TV news director in the country, including the major networks, use these. The local stations use them more than anyone. And if you, again, ask people in surveys which news they trust the most, it happens to be the local stations.
So what specifically are you, what is it, a station that you will be giving an award to?
Well, I'm giving it rather generically to America's TV news directors. There's an association in this country called the RTDNA, the Radio and TV News Directors Association, RTNDA, that is supposed to be sort of an ethical self-policing body for TV news. The Radio and TV News Directors Association has a policy that while they feel it's okay to use this provided news footage and provided news stories, they should be flagged and identified. It would be very easy to do. Simply put a little electronic symbol in the bottom of the screen or a phrase that indicated that what you're watching is not really news. It's what looks like a news footage provided by a pharmaceutical company or a car company or a chemical company. But virtually no one does it. There's just simple outright lying and deception going on across the board in the TV news industry. And this really fits in with the downsizing that's going on in TV journalism. This stuff is free. So if I have 20 minutes of local TV news time to fill, and I can fill 10 of that with provided video news releases from corporations, that's 10 minutes of expensive programming that I get for free. I can lay off news people. I can provide really polished products. And of course, the VNRs are very well done, and they tend to either pertain to fluff or carry a corporate message about an important political issue.
John Stauber, you just heard the two segments we did on Zaire. And one of the ways countries like Zaire and other countries that would have a bad name if it weren't for the help of the U.S. government and also PR flacks in this country, one of the things they do is they hire PR flacks to improve their image. We know it with Indonesia, Burson Marsteller, Hill and Knowlton. We know it with Zaire. And you have a piece in your latest PR news, your PR Watch, called China's Corporate Friends in High and Low Places. Can you talk about China and the PR industry?
At PR Watch, often very interesting internal documents sort of fall into our lap or show up in the mail. This is a graphic that we obtained from somebody who attended a public relations gathering in Florida. And if people could see this graphic, it just tells the story in a single glimpse. It's a map of the United States surrounded by boxes with big corporate names like Boeing, Nike, IBM, TRW, Conagra, GE. And then from each box, a line leading to a specific state. Nike, for instance, the line leads to the state of Oregon, where Nike is a very powerful corporation. Boeing, it leads to Seattle. General Motors, it leads to Michigan. And then a number. For Nike, the number is 4 out of 5. And that number means that 4 of the 5 representatives from the state of Oregon, because of Nike's lobbying, voted to give China most favored nation status in trade in 1996. This is a very critical issue. It's in the news very much now. And what this map constitutes is really industry bragging rights about how these massive corporations mobilized at the grassroots in the states where they had the most power to work together behind the scenes as a lobby coalition to ensure that China would be granted this most favored nation trading status with the United States. And this is basically how corporations work these days to dominate grassroots politics on issues that even include foreign policy. Forget human rights, forget sweatshops, forget Tiananmen Square. The bottom line here is access to China's market. And that's what these corporations, Boeing, for instance, sells about 10% of its planes now to China. And that's really going to increase in the future. So they have a tremendous stake in opening up the Chinese market.
Speaking about another foreign policy issue that definitely impacts domestic life here in this country, the headline in the New York Times on Friday, "In Victory for U.S., Europe Ban on Treated Beef is Ruled Illegal." It says the European Union's ban on hormone-treated beef is illegal, a panel of the World Trade Organization has decided, potentially giving the American cattle industry a big victory, but also turning over new ground on issues of national sovereignty. In a preliminary report, which has not yet been released to the public, the organization says Europe's import ban on beef produced with growth-enhancing hormones is illegal because it has no scientific justification, this according to American officials who have seen the report. Now, you are, in addition to doing PR Watch, writing a book with Sheldon Rampton on mad cow disease. Can you talk about how this fits in?
Sure. Sheldon and I wrote Toxic Sludge is Good for You, Lies, Damn Lies, and the Public Relations Industry a year ago. Pardon me. And that book gets into, in parts, how the public relations industry has worked on behalf of the food industry to prevent people from being able to make the food choices they want to make, especially on these controversial new issues like genetically engineered food and hormones in dairy cows and beef. People in Europe, people in the United States, overwhelmingly in surveys, want to avoid food that they feel comes from animals that are on growth hormones. It's very sensible. There's nothing here for consumers. You don't say, give me that burger with the growth hormones in it. You know, I'm feeling a little down today. The headline in the New York Times, a little short today, yeah. The headlines in the New York Times is ironic. This is no victory for the U.S. It's a tremendous financial victory for the U.S. beef industry. Now, how does this all pull together with Mad Cow USA, our next book? People in the United States think Mad Cow is some bizarre food scare in Britain. What they don't realize is that Britain is facing a potentially devastating human epidemic as people begin to die of this Alzheimer's-like disease from meat they ate in the 1980s. There are some 16 people, young people in Britain, now dying of an Alzheimer's-like disease called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease that's essentially mad cow disease in people. Well, the cannibalized feeding practice of feeding cows back to cows that has unleashed that disease in Britain continues to this day in the United States, even though recommendations have been to end it for almost a decade. People don't understand
that. Where you grind beef into the feed for cows.
Right. What happens quickly is that half of every meat animal is actually waste, offal, stuff that can't be eaten by humans. And so there's this industry we don't talk much about in the United States called the rendering industry. They take that terrible stuff and they cook it into a variety of products, one of which is animal feed that's fed back to feed. And so a dementia disease called transmissible spongiform encephalopathies is transmitted through this cannibal process. It's very frightening. There's an excellent book already out on this called Deadly Feasts by Richard Rhodes, which I would recommend. It's as a critic of the public relations industry, it's very interesting to look how different industries handle PR, and one of the scariest is the food industry. They have successfully, over the last few years, passed libel laws at the state level, which are completely transforming what journalists and citizen activists can say about food safety issues.
No, I mean, this is unbelievable.
These are the food disparagement laws. I heard you talking about this at the Project Censored Awards
that were given to journalists whose whose reports didn't get picked up anywhere else up at Columbia University last week. What are these libel laws?
They're called food disparagement laws. Over a quarter of the states now have them. They were put in place by the feed industry and the food industry. And the best way to explain what they're supposed to do is by looking at an Oprah Winfrey show that was aired a year ago. Oprah Winfrey, most popular entertainer in the United States, extremely influential, had as a guest Howard Lyman of the Humane Society of the United States. And for an hour, or actually for 20 minutes of the show, they discussed, along with a representative of the U.S. government and the cattle industry, the risks of mad cow disease here in the U.S. The next day, the beef market plummeted. Oprah was blamed, and about 3 weeks later, a millionaire rancher in Texas sued Oprah under that state's food disparagement law, saying that Oprah had caused the problem, that the show had essentially libeled beef. And it's completely shut up. Oprah Winfrey, she's going to have to appear in court some months down the road. There's been virtually no coverage of the important information on the program, which is that the risk of mad cow here in the U.S. is very real because the government and the beef industry has failed to act. And this is the first suit brought in the United States to shut up food activists and journalists when they simply try to inform the American people and encourage debate over critical food issues. So it sort of goes hand in hand with what you asked me about, the hormone issue in Europe. The World Trade Organization, unfortunately, is telling Europeans that they can no longer restrict the use of hormones in beef. But again, across the board, consumers of beef want to know that their beef is safe, that it's not coming from cows fed cows, and that it's free of hormones and growth promotants.
I mean, could you be sued or Democracy Now! Be sued just for airing this information right now in certain states?
Yes. Yes, we could be sued for having this discussion. Because if I were to say something, for instance, that that I believe and that is factually correct, such as there is a serious risk that the United States could develop a mad cow type disease, I could be sued and you could be sued for what I just said. Because in these states, the libel law isn't based on whether or not what you said is true. It's simply a hook on which somebody can hang a lawsuit. And until Howard Lyman of the Humane Society or Oprah Winfrey or somebody sued in that case, for instance, gets these laws declared unconstitutional, they're on the books, and people are going to be harassed and, as they say, slapped and intimidated by these multi-million dollar food disparagement suits.
You know, it's interesting. This weekend I was in Tennessee at the Highlander Center outside Knoxville, where Southern groups had gathered from throughout, Tennessee and West Virginia and North and South Carolina, Florida, to push for clean money campaigns, to start a whole movement around clean money campaigns, because these laws get signed into law by politicians who are on the payroll of, and well, in the case you're talking about, the beef industry.
The beef industry is very powerful at the grassroots, and it's interesting to see the way these laws did come about. There's a group in Washington called the Animal Industry Foundation. It's supported by agribusiness across the board. They developed a model for this law and distributed it to the grassroots network.
Well, if people want to get your information, if people want to get PR Watch, the newsletter that you put out, can you tell people a phone number or where you can find it on the web?
The best thing to do is write us, PR Watch, Madison, Wisconsin. The address is 3318 Gregory Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53711. Our website is prwatch.org/.
prwatch.org/. And if folks, if you'd like to get a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Our guest has been John Stauber, the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, based in Madison, Wisconsin. Well, Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Our engineer and assistant producer is Errol Maitland. Special thanks to Brother Shine, who recorded the Laurent Kabila interview earlier. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. Special thanks to Alambe Brath. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!